It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the great civilizations of sugar. Ancient India and Persia may have given the English-speaking world medicine, mathematics, art, and trade, but those were a mere bagatelle compared to what they contributed to candy. Our guest is Tim Richardson, author of Sweets, A History of Candy. Road Warriors Jane and Michael Stern are into pancakes on steroids at Jewelerette's in Charlevoix, Michigan. Cook Sally Schneider has found inspiration from the honeybee. Food critic David Rosengarten has a dynamite stand-in for wine. And we talk to the head of Bazaar ND, his words, at Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. All this sweetness and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you. Yeah. We're going to get on tonight. We're going to get into it. Get on tonight. This is your tune. I woke up this morning. Yeah, in the hospital bed. She must have thought I was dead. They found me sitting underneath a tree. Was out cold by the roadside, but only sleeping, don't you see? So they check my liver and they check my blood and all kind of tests to see what I've done. Call the doctor, intern, a specialist too. Say we don't know what's wrong with you. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
Oh, no, no way. What's my problem, man?
Too much barbecue.
Ah, you got to be bullshit. I mean, what's my real problem, man?
Too much barbecue.
No, no way. I mean, now, what's my problem?
Barbecue.
Uh-uh. But I was born with a rib tip. Just sitting in my hand, huh? And I was eating whole chickens before I was age 10. Woo! Mama told me, my papa told me too. Yeah, down you go, pretty son. Might be the death of you. Oh, I don't be no chance. And I get to ride in my Scoopy wheel. Have a glass of biscuits and a charcoal wheel. That line of ice trays are mounted on the face. A stereo speakers all over the place. 16 cheeseburgers we got sitting in a sack. About a half pound cheesecake. Now we're gonna get through with that. Woo! Might grab a hump, an alligator pie, slap it all on the grill now. Well, nothing raw and nothing fried. So they are. Check my liver and they'll check my blood. Ran all kind of tests to see what I've done. Call the doctor, intern, a specialist too. Say we don't know what's wrong with you. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
I can't believe you're telling me this, man. Woo! Now what's my problem, huh?
Too much barbecue.
Get your hands out of my face, you're gonna have my coleslaw. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
Nah, no way. Let me hear it again. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
Nah, nah.
Thank you.
Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me?
Too much barbecue.
I ain't never had another nothing. I can't believe you telling me this. What, you talking to me?
Too much barbecue.
No way, not today. What's my problem, y'all?
Too much barbecue.
What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
No way. Not today. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
I ain't going for that at all. What's my real problem? Let me hear you.
Too much barbecue.
Barbecue.
Yeah. You all right?
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's sweets. We're covering candy, honey, ice cream, and throwing in a little dysfunction for good measure. Our guest is Tim Richardson, author of Sweets, A History of Candy. Crack cook Sally Schneider is into new ways for using honey. We have a tale of sugar, family one-upsmanship, and justice. Food critic David Rosengarten has choice picks of hard ciders. Then it's how Ben and Jerry's ice creams get their flavors with the chief of what they call the Bizarre MD department. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, what have you two been up to?
We have been in Charlevoix, Michigan, at a place called Jewelerette's of Charlevoix, and I had, without a doubt, the best pancake I have ever had in my life.
Is this a breakfast place?
Well, no, it's an everything place. It's breakfast and lunch and dinner?
No dinner.
Breakfast and lunch.
A nice town cafe.
And I am usually very disappointed when I eat pancakes in restaurants. They're just doughy and sort of thick and unpleasant. This was a pancake that took probably 20 minutes to make. It was huge. And in the middle of it was, it had to be a half a pound of freshly picked raspberries and blueberries with fabulous syrup, powdered sugar, and honey. And this, the consistency of the pancake was light and fluffy and just had this wonderful, wonderful taste to it. It was probably the best pancake I've ever had, except for the one Michael makes, which are terrific.
Now, wait, where is Charlevoix?
Charlevoix is way up in the lower part of Michigan. It's not quite at the Upper Peninsula. It's in Benzie County, which is where they grow all the great cherries. And one of the interesting things about this Jewelerette's is that it is not the Jewelerette's of Harbor Springs, nor is it even related to it. There are two Jewelerette's up there. The one in Harbor Springs is a great place in its own right because it's one of the few restaurants anywhere that we know which serves planked Lake Superior whitefish. This is fillets of whitefish cooked on a wooden plank,
mm-hmm.
surrounded by a wall of mashed potatoes that shore in all the buttery juices of the fish when it cooks. I mean, this is one of the great Great Lakes meals. But anyway, that's in Harbor Springs. Down in Charlevoix, this Jewelerette's is more of a wonderful town cafe. As Jane said, the pancakes are unbelievably good. The breads they make there, it's also a bakery. And when you walk in, the first thing you see are shelves of their incredible homemade breads.
I mean, and the Michigan maple rolls, which were incredible.
And sticky buns, maple rolls, cinnamon bread, banana walnut bread.
And I don't know if you can add this, but their coconut cream pie, or is that in a pie case?
I don't know. The coconut cream pie was on our table at the end of the meal, I can assure you that. What's better to have after a big pancake than a slice of coconut cream pie?
If you're going to do carbs, you might as well do carbs all the way.
Yeah. But in between those two things, we did enjoy a fabulous whitefish sandwich. I mean, this is not just a bakery-type place. I mean, everything at this restaurant is kind of extra special. I mean, this was the freshest, kind of firm, flaky, moist whitefish like you just don't get anywhere other than around the Great Lakes.
So is this a tourist area?
a lot of people from Detroit and lower Michigan head up in this direction in the summer. Many people have summer homes in this vicinity. But to call it a tourist area, I don't want to make it sound like Gatlinburg. I mean, there aren't a lot of big, flashy tourist attractions here. I mean, there are some lovely lakefront areas and, you know, beautiful orchards to visit. Yes, it is a place where people go, especially in the summertime, because it's so nice up there, and you can pick your own fruit in so many places. But it's not a heavily trod tourist area.
There's something very turn of the century about it and unspoiled. And also, it's, you know, the lakes are just so pretty there. I mean, there's just something very pastoral and calming and lovely about this area.
And then you can do intravenous raspberry berry pancake.
Okay. Oh, I don't want to intravenous. I want to put them in my mouth.
Strictly oral here.
Yes, I want the full satisfaction. No IV raspberries for me.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Okay, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Oh, Michigan, that's our bunch of replication. Oh, Michigan, oh, Michigan. The tank fishes are in expansionist in speed.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, every week you hear the Sterns here, but you can get their road food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're checking out the website, don't miss signing up for our free weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique tips, and shopping info. And we are unrolling a dynamite new design. So get to the website, sign up, splendidtable.org. Writer Sally Schneider's latest book is called A New Way to Cook. And this isn't idle PR. Sally has an uncanny way of taking great food, getting rid of a lot of the fat, and at the same time, making it taste great. Well, she joins us again today. Sally, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Sally, you know what I'd like to talk to you about? I want to talk about honey, because I am watching all these bees working all those flowers. I want to know what you'd like to do with honey.
Well, let me tell you about my honey revelations. I didn't really understand what honey is until I made friends with a hair colorist who has another life. She's a New York City, chic as can be, beautiful woman. She's really a farmer and beekeeper in upstate New York. And I went and visited her last summer at harvest time and discovered what these bees are really doing. First of all, she was terrified of bees when her husband had the idea to keep them. And she told me that what really drew her in was the sound that they make. Listen to this description. She said there was an overwhelming feeling of harmony, like nature being amplified. Now, what the bees are doing something they have done for thousands of years, and she is keeping bees in a way that hasn't changed for thousands of years. Bees gather nectar, and what I never really understood, the nectar from the flowers is transformed in their bodies into honey. There are minerals and enzymes that affect this transformation. It also purifies the honey. They take it back to the hive where they deposited it into the combs. And I'm sure everybody has seen these incredible wax hexagonal grids that they also make that make such delicious smelling candles. Now, it takes about 100,000 to 500,000 journeys to collect enough nectar for 1 quart of honey. That's thousands of trips to fill a teaspoon. So I began to really have respect, not only for the bees, but for Mary and her husband, because they are basically, they're trying to take care of the bees because they believe so much in this product. It's so beautiful, and her honey is sensational. Now, let's get back to some of the practicalities. That's the kind of mystery of it. I've got honey sitting in my pantry that I use all the time. But I don't use it just for making honey-based dishes, like I make a fabulous tomato jam with Moroccan flavors because it loves tomatoes and ginger and cinnamon and garlic and lemon zest, or a nougat ice cream from the Alice Toklas cookbook that I've kind of adapted and that sort of thing. Here's an example of what I do with it almost every day. I use a lot of dessert wine in my cooking, and I call for it in my recipes. Now, these can be very expensive, so I thought I better devise a substitute. Well, I discovered that if you stir a good wildflower honey into a dry white wine, you get something very, very, very similar to a good dessert wine.
Huh.
It's as inexpensive as can be. Both of those are staple ingredients in my pantry. And I can take the wine, use it in sauces or in braises or in marinades. I can also cook that into a syrup that I'll pour over fresh fruits, cherries, berries, melon, peaches. And sometimes I'll change the kind of honey I use because bear in mind, the honey is the product of the flower, so it will have many of the characteristics of the flower that it is from, unless it's a mix of wildflowers. So you can use honey as a kind of fragrant flavoring. Quinces are fabulous cooked in white wine and honey. It seems to bring out all their natural perfume. As for eating it, this is, again, not even getting into cooking. Honey loves cheeses, from mild goat cheese and fresh cow cheeses to aged sheep's milk cheeses, which are fabulous. So I make these kind of open-faced sandwiches with honey on olive bread with a mild goat cheese, on walnut bread with prosciutto. I eat it
this...
on...
I'm sorry, I've got to stop you. It sounds so good. Olive bread, honey, the sweet... the salt, the rich, and
exactly.
Then the cheese. Oh, brother.
And that way, you some people feel that honey is one note, it's too sweet or whatever. When you start using the single flower honeys and using them in conjunction with salt and savory foods, you get this fabulous nuance.
Ah, Sally, you did it again. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. She left us with a great honey recipe, Alice B. Toklas's nougat ice cream, and sources for her honey pals. You can get it all on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the making of our national sweet tooth, sugar and family revenge, hard ciders, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/supertarget.
won't do to dream of caramel, to think of cinnamon and long for you.
So supposedly the first flavor we humans recognize and like is sweetness. Evidently, nature hardwired us this way for good reasons. Mother's milk is sweet, healthy fruit is sweet, most poisons are bitter, so you have nourishment and protection. It's perfectly logical. Yet, it is not a long leap from mother's milk to popping nerds in front of the TV. All the world loves candy. Humans have been eating sweets since the first cave person sucked on a twig of sweet licorice. British writer Tim Richardson is a self-confessed candy addict. He writes for newspapers and magazines, and he is the author of Sweets, A History of Candy. Tim, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for asking me on.
So, Tim, how did the addiction begin? How did you get into sweets?
Well, retrospectively, I suppose it might have had something to do with the fact that my father was a dentist. So, you know, my sweets consumption was fairly rationed when I was a child.
Uh-huh.
So they always seemed to be rather exotic and dangerous for me, and I always hoarded them. So probably it comes from that. But my father's father, if you'll just indulge me in this family history for a minute, his father was actually a sweets business person who went across the Middle East tracking down fine Turkish delight and the like. So I suppose there's this sort of genetic disorder. It's good, evil, good, evil. And I'm obviously the good generation.
Okay. Well, there's real reason for this. So let's talk about what has shaped the sweets that we know. You mentioned something about a triumvirate in the book.
Yeah, I mean, over the couple of years it took me to research this, I suppose the main conclusion I came to was that there have been three great sweet-eating civilizations in history. The first being India, both ancient and modern, and so you're talking about India from about 2000 BC on, because India was the first place to cultivate sugar and use it to make sweets. The second is the Arab Empire, the Islamic Empire, from 632 AD, death of Muhammad, on. And the third is the English-speaking peoples from about the mid-18th century on. So that's, you know, all of us lot, Britain, the USA, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, Canada. Up until the present day, really, we kind of control the sweets business now.
Well, let's talk about India, because in the book you talk about how the sweets there taste like nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, that was the main revelation for me during my research. And like most sweetmeats in history, they haven't changed that much. Sweets in India are milk-based, mostly, with cereals, pulses and grains and rice and that sort of thing in there to thicken them up. And my favourite are barfi, which are like fudge, really, very delicately spiced with things like cardamom and pistachio and so on. Absolutely delicious, and I've got a bit of an addiction for these now. And other sweets are laddu, which are very important in Hindu ritual. And what the Hindi people do is they go to a temple and offer these sweets to the god and leave them on the altar, at which point the name of them is boga. And then when the god has sort of symbolically accepted them, they're called prasad, and then you're allowed to eat them, which is pretty good.
A very civilized economic system. Well, now take us into the Arab world.
Well, the key to the cuisine of the Arab world was Persia, because as the newly converted Islamic army went through the Middle East in very short order, in 75 years, remember, they had conquered Syria, Persia, Egypt, gone into North Africa, Cyprus, and in Spain by 711 AD. But always Persia was first and foremost, and a part and parcel of that culture was the mixture of sweet and sour in cooking. So you have gorgeous dishes, which you can still get in Persian restaurants now, things like jeweled rice, in which sugar is actually sprinkled on the top of the rice in order to make it glisten, because sugar was used as much for its visual qualities as for its sweetness. And there's no problem in that cuisine with mixing sweetness and savoury tastes. And we sort of think now that we don't do that, but we do it all the time. If you think about ketchup, for example, it's basically a sweet sauce. And that's really a medieval legacy.
I always think of the Arabs also giving us boiled sugar. You know, the things that made hard candies and that kind of thing, because they sort of seem to have perfected the way you work with boiling sugar. Is that true?
Absolutely. That is true. Yeah, I mean, during the Crusades and after the Crusades, through Venice, these trade links were established, and sugar was one of the commodities. It was officially a spice, which was a highly valued item. It was a foodstuff and also a medicine and a preservative. So the way of actually transporting things like lemons and oranges, of course, they would deteriorate on the voyage. So what they did would be to bathe them in repeated vats of gloopy sugar syrup and then frost them with sugar. And that's how people in medieval Europe actually enjoyed oranges and lemons.
Candied fruit.
Candied fruit. Exactly. Yeah. It is the same. Now, we now today can buy. There's no difference whatsoever between that and what people were having in the 1100s. Although, of course, in the 1100s, only the kings could afford it. And other things came from the Middle East, comfits, which are like red hots are comfits, you know, like hard sugar encasing a little cinnamon something or mm-hmm. a little pine cone mm-hmm. or an almond. You know, a sugared almond is a typical comfit. And these were made by being put in a big pan and sort of shimmied around in the sugar for a long, long period. And, of course, these are still made in exactly the same way as well.
So now let's go to the English-speaking peoples. I'm thinking of essentially the Great Britain and America.
Yeah, well, what happened there was the price of sugar really went down and down and down through the 18th and into the 19th century as huge amounts of sugar on the back of slavery, it has to be said, were imported into Britain. And by the 1840s, you were getting lots of sweetie wives, they were called, were making these boiled sweets or hard candies.
These were women.
Yeah, many women did this. All you needed was a copper pan and a copper spoon, and you could boil up sugar and make candies and sell them on the street. So it was a very useful sideline. And from there, the English-speaking peoples got a great taste for sweetness through having sugar in tea initially, but then just through having sweets. And the English-speaking peoples have always eaten, or traditionally always eaten, far more sweets than anyone else. Particularly in Scotland, in the borders of Scotland, there are many, many lovely sweets. Like there's one called Sour Plumes, which is Scots dialect for sour plums, and they're small, green, spherical objects, and you put one of these in your mouth, and it is lip-piercingly sour. Very nice indeed, actually. You know, that's a typical boiled sweet of the area.
Well, Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Journalist Tim Richardson is based in England, where he writes for national publications, including the Sunday Times, Country Life, and Wallpaper. He's the author of Sweets, A History of Candy. Sugar cuts a wide path through global history, even working its way into the fabric of the family, seeping into the cracks of relationships. At least that's what writer Bix Scahill believes.
I grew up in the golden age of sugar. Sugar-laden cereals proliferated the market, candy bars became a dietary staple, and Kool-Aid came in pre-sweetened packs for those who couldn't cook. Sugar was king, and I was its servant. One dire year in the early 70s, the sugar crop failed. Analysts predicted sugar prices would skyrocket. Mrs. Freeberg, who lived down the block, earned the lifelong title of genius by having the foresight of running down to Hunt's Grocery and buying 500 pounds of sugar. Her bounty, which she proudly displayed to the neighbors, took up the entirety of her pantry. Today, people still talk about Mrs. Freeberg's shrewd, sugary move. But sugar's golden days came to a close. Sugar became vilified, the first public enemy number one of the health movement. News reports and rumors flew. Sugar got yoked with the unfortunate triple threat of rotting your teeth, ballooning your weight, and making you hyper. There are not a lot of pro-sugar people left around, but I am one of them. Okay, sugar does rot your teeth, but it is not fattening. Each tablespoon has only 13 calories. It's just that sugar hangs around with some bad ingredients, butter and oils and fluffy nougat. And as far as making kids hyper, being a kid makes kids hyper. There have been numerous studies in the last few years that have tied kids' hyperactivity not to sugar overdoses, but to the situations in which those overdoses occur, birthday parties, picnics, and state fairs. I've seen this firsthand. Every summer, our cousins visited for a week. We considered them from the East Coast because they lived in Ohio, and we thought of them as cultured. They thought the same thing. Their mother, my aunt, was constantly battling at the forefront of the health movement, and sugar was her arch nemesis. While my family guzzled bottle upon bottle of pop, our cousins were only allowed the occasional glass of water. At the breakfast table, we devoured bowl after bowl of sugar-coated fluff. They had Wheaties. Of course, they were just as hyper, in a cultured way, as we were, but more bitter. At last check, the two girls of that family were in detox, and the two boys were eking out a living by dressing up like holiday characters and walking around the local mall. A fitting end, I think. I'm not advising you to binge on sugar. Just if you want the occasional candy bar, indulge yourself. I would hate to think that I gave up sugar and accidentally stepped in front of a bus the next day. My final thought on this earth would be, oh, if I'd only had that Reese's peanut butter cup.
Just give me the old sugar blues. Oh, play me that low-down melody. Now you can have your St. Louis, your bebopping too. And you can have your hidey-hoes, but here's a tune that tickles my toes.
Bix Cahill is a writer and new dad in Los Angeles. We wonder if the babe is eating Pop-Tarts. Wine Authority David Rosengarten started his career as a wine maven, moved into writing award-winning cookbooks, and now applies his brilliantly honed palate to a newsletter. In the Rosengarten Report, David tastes, David critiques, and David tells all. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Lynn. Always great to be here.
I'd like to talk about cider with you because it's fall and it's the perfect time of year for cider.
And most Americans tend to overlook hard cider. I mean, we drink a lot of simple apple juice, I guess, but there's another amazing category out there.
That's right, and it's like wine. And again, you know, we just don't see that much of it. So can you give us some backdrop?
Well, I got excited about cider some years back when I was traveling in the Basque region of Spain, where they have these big cider houses, and they're eating houses, but they have this fabulous, fizzy, very lightly alcoholic cider. It's maybe, you know, it's like beer. It's maybe 4% alcohol. It's totally dry, and it is just a joy to drink with food and to drink by itself. So back in the U.S., I was trying to find something similar to the Basque cider, but not easy to do. And so I started to explore American-made ciders. We also have a lot of imports from France and from the UK. There's almost nothing in this country from Spain. Lynn, the very best cider that I found in the U.S. is made in the U.S., in Lebanon, New Hampshire. The label on the cider is Farnham Hill Extra Dry Cider. They also make a semi-dry cider. And these have the kind of complexity that you find in the European ciders. They're absolutely, absolutely wonderful, and you can visit the farm during harvest time as well. Most of the cider that you find in the U.S., you find not in the dry style like that, or like the cider in Spain. Uh-huh. You find in an off-dry style. And there are some awfully good ones out there from Normandy in particular. But I wanted to tell your listeners about one cider that's kind of widely available. It's also American. It's called Woodpecker Cider.
Oh, I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you see it everywhere. You can find it in the supermarket. And it says on the label English cider, but it's fooling you. It's actually made in the U.S., in Vermont, again, in New England. But it's a terrific cider that I think people will really enjoy. And it's got a little bit of sweetness to it. You know, sometimes the problems with these ciders that are available in the supermarkets is they taste merely like apple juice or sweetened apple juice. But a great cider should have additional complexity of flavor like good wine does.
Mm-hmm.
Then, when you look around in the market, you're going to find that there are sweet ciders also. And I think of these as dessert ciders. There is a terrific one from France. The producer's name is Eric Bordelais. And he has a cider that's called Cidre Doux, sweet cider. I'd call it medium sweet, but it's got a wonderful kind of sour apple mash kind of taste to it. And it's really good with fruit tarts and things like that.
Well, backing up a little bit, though, with the dry ciders, do you just use them as though they were dry wines?
I do, in fact. I mean, I like to take, you could drink it by itself, to be sure, but I like to cook with it. I make a dish of sort of Normandy-style mussels. I take mussels and I steam them open, not with wine, but with cider, with dry cider. And then in the pot, I mix in a little good cream along with the cider, and you have a wonderful broth for those mussels. And then to drink with it, you would drink one of these dry ciders, like this Farnham Hill from New Hampshire would be perfect. Sometimes I drink them like wine with a meal without having cooked with the cider first. So, for example, a roast chicken and a nice glass, in a wine glass, you know, treat it well. A nice
right.
glass of dry or off-dry cider is absolutely fabulous. I mean, the thing to understand is that when you're choosing beverages to go with food, you've got wine to be sure, you've got beer to be sure, but you've also got hard cider. It's a fabulous category.
And the alcohol content's lower.
Very much. It's much more like beer than it is like wine. Though some, the Farnham Hill that I particularly like, that's at about 7.5% alcohol. But most of the time, it's more like 4 or 5% alcohol.
David, would the off-dry ciders be a stand-in for Riesling with spicy foods?
Oh, you've got a great idea there, Lynn. Absolutely. I mean, it's all kinds of spicy and even slightly sweet Asian foods.
Yeah.
Man, I love those with slightly off-dry Rieslings, and they'd be great with off-dry ciders. Good idea.
Thanks, and we'll try it. Hey, thanks a lot, David.
Okay, to your health.
David Rosengarten is creator of the Rosengarten Report. You can find information on David's cider picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, today's question is, what food did the physicians of ancient Egypt always have in their medical bags? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle, online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what food did the physicians of ancient Egypt always have in their medical bags? It was honey.
Healers in ancient Egypt treated wounds and infections with honey, as did the Greeks, the Romans, and even doctors in World War I. It works because honey is dense with sugar, 80% worth. When the honey goes on a wound, it absorbs fluids from it and combines with an enzyme that the bee has given the honey. This combo makes hydrogen peroxide, which is a disinfectant. This quality in honey made it a favorite preservative of the ancient world. People immersed everything in it, meat, roots, vegetables, fruit. And by the by, honey research as an antibiotic is going on 3 continents right now. Who knows? Maybe the next miracle drug. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Tom on the line. So, Tom, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, I love smoked food.
Uh-huh.
And I let that be known, and somebody gave me a bottle of liquid smoke.
That's sort of like giving Chanel number 5.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
I have no idea what to do with it. I was in a grocery store one time, and they were handing out some kind of a fish that they got out of the Atlantic Ocean, and it was smoked. And I kept going around the girl to get another sample. I just love this stuff. And I let that be known, and somebody gave me this bottle, and I don't know where to go with it.
Well, does it smell good?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because the thing about liquid smoke is, and I have to confess, I haven't done a lot of work with it. Sometimes it smells funny and sometimes it just smells good. It smells like smoke.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, I think what it actually is smoke that's sort of captured in water.
Yeah.
So it's pretty pure.
Yeah.
I'm going to do an educated guess here.
What?
I would probably blend it with your other favorite flavors, let's say for a marinade or rub. In so many words, consider it a very potent form of smoke.
Yes.
Okay. Let's take a piece of fish, salmon, flounder, whatever. But I think of things like salmon because they're moist and they're juicy,
yeah,
and they tend to be meaty. And I'd say take a very small amount of that liquid smoke, like maybe a half teaspoon, and blend it with a little bit of something like soy sauce and brown sugar and garlic.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And rub that into the fish. Put it in the fridge for a half hour and then either grill it or pan saute it. Make it however you like it.
Uh-huh.
Now, before you actually add it to the fish, taste it. See if that combination is right for you. Is it too much smoke?
Taste the mixture first.
Yeah, yeah, before you add it to the fish.
Okay.
And don't ever marinate fish more than about a half hour, and you always keep it in the fridge. And then see if this gives you the flavor that you like.
Yeah.
And I'd say play with it. I have used it occasionally when I've done spare ribs. And I've rubbed it into the spare ribs along with, spices and other goodies.
Ah.
Like, for instance, I love real Hungarian paprika on my spare ribs. So I will do cumin, coriander, paprika, a little liquid smoke,
uh-huh,
some kind of hot pepper, and a ton of garlic. And I'll stick that in the fridge overnight, and then I'll slow roast it in the oven.
I like all those things you mentioned.
Fool with it, but taste,
mm-hmm,
first, because you may find it's very strong or it's not pleasing to you.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Okay.
The worst thing that'll happen is you won't use it. But
well,
the best thing will happen is you've got a shortcut to flavors you love.
If I get good at it, I'll call you back and let you know.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Anil on the line. Anil, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Len. Thanks for taking my call. I use a lot of tamarind in cooking, and I was in India recently. And we were staying at this hotel where they had a lot of tamarind trees and all the tamarind pods were falling down. And I remembered my youth when I was a kid of 10, 11, 12, we used to pick up all the tamarind pods from the ground, pop them open, and eat the tamarind straight off and spit the stones out.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And when I saw all these tamarind pods lying around, I thought, there's no way I'm going to let them just lie on the ground. So I picked up a ton of them. And I know that they have a long shelf life. So I brought them back to New York, and I have stuck them in my freezer.
Right.
Now I want to know what I can do with them, because I generally buy slabs of tamarind, the tamarind paste and the tamarind concentrate and things.
Right,
but
right.
I've got the real thing, and I'm just wondering what I can do with them.
Oh, I envy you. Well, for those who are not familiar with tamarind, it is a dark, luscious substance that grows around these seeds in these long pods. They look like overweight green beans, is maybe
that's right. Yeah.
I mean, they're really plump, long pods, and the tamarind is fruity and sour. First of all, you know, you pull it out of the pod, right? With all the seeds, put a little hot water over it. You let it soak. You push it through a strainer. You leave the seed behind.
Yes.
Right. Puree that mixture, okay, with a little sugar to taste, and then add bubbly mineral water to it and put it over ice. It is fabulous.
Oh, great.
It is the best summer cooler in the entire world.
Okay, we've got a dinner party coming up, and I've already pre-cooked some things, and I'm going to be grilling probably chicken. My wife won't let me eat red meat because of my heart. I was hoping to use it in the in some kind of a marinade.
Oh,
but
it's wonderful in a marinade. It's wonderful in a marinade.
And I've got enough of it to make a lot of summer coolers and use it in a marinade. So I'll probably try that this weekend.
Well, the marinade, do the exact same thing. Soak it, you know, just to get it off the pods.
Right.
That's the whole thing. Get it off the seed. And then one of the things that's, it's, you know, it's wonderful with almost anything, from green beans to lamb and fish. But one of the things that I do is I add a little bit of brown sugar and I toast cumin seed and then grind it and throw that in.
Right.
And some garlic, and it glazes.
Okay, that sounds fabulous. I'll let you know how it gets on.
You know, you can do a soup to nuts tamarind feast.
Yes, I could. I've got two fairly substantial bags of tamarind pods.
All right, I throw out one last thought.
Yep.
Tamarind sorbet. And on that note, I bid you bon voyage.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You take care, Neil.
Right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Talk about over the top. Fresh tamarind? I'd feast. It's like eating tomatoes, you know? Soup to nuts. Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Stanley calling. Stanley, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, I grew this vegetable cardoon. It's an ancient vegetable. I say it's popular in France in the Mediterranean area.
Oh, yeah.
Makes
yeah.
a beautiful silver grayish green plant. The
right.
woodchucks don't bother it. The rabbits don't bother it. Except I couldn't eat it.
Neither do the people bother with it. What was the problem?
I didn't know how to cook it.
Uh-huh.
I've heard that the French chefs, it was a test of their culinary skill to make it edible, maybe.
Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, you see, now you're talking to a lady who grew up in an Italian family. And for those who have never seen it, it looks like overgrown celery, but it's grayish green and it can have little stickers up the side of the stalk, if I remember correctly, right? And it gives off these big leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And what a lot of growers do is the stalks come right out of the ground, is they'll often wrap paper around it to keep them from getting too green.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll blanch it. Yeah, essentially blanch it the way you do celery. But normally what needs to be done is, there's a lot of waste to cardoon. It needs to be the outer tough stalks you discard, the inner ones you peel as though you would be peeling celery, you know, with a vegetable peeler to get rid of those, the tough outer stalk, and also to get rid of any things that might be sticky. You trim away the leaves, and you parboil it in salted water. That's one of the keys to it. So before you do anything, you usually do that.
Parboil in salted water.
About 10 minutes or so until it's tender. You cut it up into bite-sized pieces. And after that, one of the lovely things to do, and you know, you can do that and then stick it in the fridge and forget about it for a day or two if you want. Oh, one other thing. My grandmother always put lemon in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Then at that point, just at room temperature, you can dip it into this wonderful hot dipping sauce that comes from northern Italy. It's called bagna cauda, which means hot bath. And what it is a ton of garlic, a half a ton of anchovies, a lot of olive oil, salt and pepper, and some butter. And you let that all stew together until the garlic is almost dissolved. And you dip the cardone warm into that. The warm sauce, the cardone can be any temperature you want. The other thing is, layer it in a casserole, add some tomatoes, add a little cream and cheese, and bake it off in the oven as a gratin.
Sounds great.
It's super. And by the way, straight from the stalk, after you've peeled it, if you dip in batter and deep fried, it's good too.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'll try it with growing lemongrass too. I think I'll try some of that in there. I love the flavor of lemongrass.
Oh, that would be great. That would be an interesting combination. It'd be sort of Mediterranean meets Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So give it a shot. It's those outer tough stalks that are tricky. When you get into the inside, it's usually, I'd say, 30 to 50% of that plant is probably waste.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting, and you're right, really ancient vegetable.
Beautiful plant.
Oh, it's a gorgeous, it's a member of the artichoke family, I think.
Right.
But you're the gardener. You would know. Anyway, and if nothing else, it looks so pretty in the garden. That gray-green color is so lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
Oh, you're welcome.
I hadn't thought about cardone in ages. You take care, Stanley.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Onions. Onions are in their prime right now. And I really think, talk about an ignored vegetable in the summer. They're going to be juicy. Yeah, they're going to make you cry like crazy. But you know what's great to do is take the entire onion, just cut away the dirty root end and wash it, obviously. Cut a big X in it, leave the skin on, and slow roast it on the edge of the grill until you can stick a knife into it easily. And then you pry the top open with two forks. And what you put in there is either cream cheese or sour cream with a ton of chives and basil. The other thing that's fabulous is hot fruit salsa. Hot meaning pepper hot. And the onions can be at room temperature. They can be warm off the grill. Just fill up that roasted onion. It'll melt in your mouth. It is so delicious. I cannot tell you. The other thing you have got to stock up on right now, if it's still in the market for you, depending on where you are, is green garlic. I'm talking about fresh dug garlic that still has that skin on it that is so tender you can eat it. Now, what you want to do is you want to freeze it for the winter. So I wash it, I get rid of the root end of it, and then I slice it up and I stick it in freezer bags, because what I'm going to do with it later in the winter is I'm going to braise it with olive oil and lots of black pepper and a little bit of salt, and I'm going to puree it. And then I am going to go crazy, because I can drizzle that into soups. I can put that on pasta. I can add it to bread. You know, you can do anything you want with it. Also, by the way, just make that dressing right now. And you put it over tomatoes. Corn. Yeah. Okay, garlic. You got the point. 800-537-5252. That is how you reach us. You know, some people have all the luck. Like the guy who heads the research and development department at Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. Well, his name is Arnold Carbone, and we've got him on the phone. Arnold, welcome.
Thanks for calling.
Okay, Arnold, how do you get this kind of job?
Well, I think you really have to be able to have a love for food.
I would imagine so.
And you have to have a good nose, you have to have a good sense of how things taste, and be very adventurous.
Well, you are the person who goes out and figures out what the new flavors are going to be for Ben & Jerry's, right?
Actually, there's a team of us. In the industry, it's typically called research and development, but our team, instead of R&D, we consider ourselves bizarre ND.
Now, why the bizarre?
Well, the bizarre because there's really nothing that typical about Ben & Jerry's. You know, we're our challenge is always to be on the cutting edge and come out with something that no one's ever dreamed of.
So how do you go about doing that?
Well, what we do is, believe it or not, we eat a lot of food, and we go on flavor tours. We will at sometimes go to a city, and we will check out markets, high-end restaurants, neighborhood restaurants, supermarkets, just to see what people are eating, what kind of snacks are out there. And we typically don't take a flavor or a dessert that we see and duplicate it. What we'll do is we'll take pieces of it and create our own designs.
Do you ever leave the country? I mean, is this mainly in the United States, or do you go?
Yeah, well, you know, well, Vermont's a tough place to leave, but we do have to get out. So, our first flavor tour, we traveled from Napa Valley to Ensenada, Mexico, and we ate 150 desserts in 6 days.
Oh, my God.
Three guys doing that. Last year, we traveled from London to Paris to Saint-Dizier, France, and Berlin and back. That was a combination of visiting production facilities and also checking out new markets.
Uh-huh.
We do get out of the country.
So how does a flavor come together? I mean, can you give me an example about how you pull together a flavor?
Sure. Pretty much everybody gets together and we discuss flavor designs, flavor ideas. We also get ideas from our consumers, too. Typically, we'll get about somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 letters a month. And some of our most popular flavors were suggestions from consumers, Cherry Garcia, Chunky Monkey, Chubby Hubby. So we'll get the name, and then what we do is say, what do we think that name signifies?
And then you design the ice cream around it.
Or we'll design the ice cream around it. Sometimes we'll have an ice cream flavor that will be looking for a name.
Uh-huh.
So, and then we'll just design different prototypes and different recipes and taste it until everyone agrees that this is the flavor that is going to meet the expectations of the consumers. So one of the things that we are famous for is coming out with things that have interesting textures. And also, I mean, if you look at our product line, it's not that hard to figure out that our products are very nostalgic, are more leaning towards comfort foods than high-end fancy mm-hmm. desserts. It's something that our consumers, it reminds them of their childhood. It reminds them of something that their mom and their grandmother would make in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Well, mashed potatoes and meatloaf translated into ice cream.
No, but we tried wavy gravy.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, so people were wondering whether there was going to be chicken gravy in there. And I'm not sure if you know the history with wavy gravy. Wavy gravy was the MC at Woodstock, and Ben Cohen thought it was a great flavor name. So it took us two developers, and I think we got it about a rendition 759. So I ate a lot of wavy gravy back in those days.
Arnold, thank you.
You're welcome.
Arnold Carbone heads up the research and development department at Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this. What is small, red, and whispers? A horseradish. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Just about everything you heard today and many answers to life's other mysteries can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. You can also find our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online at splendidtable.org. It's got a brand new look. So for those of you who have already registered, check it out. Let us know what you think. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.